You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the days following the 9/11 attacks, George W. Bush and his close advisors acted quickly to create a secondary judicial system, the military commission system, that could be used to try, convict, and punish captured terrorists held at Guantanamo Bay quickly, without applying any of the rights embedded in U.S. justice procedures. In his latest book called The Terror Courts, Jess Braven looks at how this hybrid parallel approach came to be and why it's been so unsuccessful at bringing detainees to justice. Mr. Braven, who is a Supreme Court correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, joins us now, along with Lieutenant Colonel Stuart Couch, who, when he was a Marine Corps attorney, refused to prosecute suspects who'd been tortured into confessing. The book is published by Yale University Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Jess Braven and Stuart Couch to our show today. Hello.
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 So, Jess, when they learned that the terrorists being held at Guantanamo would be tried by military commissions, many Americans assumed that the usual rules of military justice would be applied. But as you explain in your book, that's not what happened?
Well, no. I mean, the military commissions were a form of sort of ad hoc justice that had been used occasionally during wartime over previous centuries. The last time was right after World War II.
Because usually they're just for court-martials, aren't they?
Military justice, yes. That, I mean, the court-martial, it's the equivalent of local district court for a military unit.
So they had to come up with a new approach here?
They chose to come up. I think that's really the
question. Well, how
were
they supposed to work?
Well, how are military commissions supposed to work? The way they were envisioned initially by the Bush administration is that they would work like they did in old newsreels from the 1940s, that there would be a very quick, near summary type proceeding where the outcome was virtually certain. And the order that President Bush signed was modeled heavily on one that President Roosevelt signed in 1942 that authorized one of the most criticized military proceedings actually in American history.
Now, Stuart, you were a military prosecutor with the Marine Corps when the 9/11 attacks occurred, and didn't you immediately offer to help prosecute anyone who had been responsible for the attacks?
Well, I did. You have to understand that everybody that was on active duty on September the 11th, we all immediately realized that we would be going to war. And shortly thereafter, in November of 2001, President Bush signed the military order directing the use of military commissions for the detainees that were captured in Afghanistan.
And how did you expect them to work in the way that the rest of our judicial system works?
No, we knew. I had heard about military commissions. I had read about them both in law school, and they were briefly mentioned during my training at the Naval Justice School. However, as Jess just pointed out, the military commissions had not been utilized since World War II, although I would add that military commissions have been used previous to that time throughout the history of the nation.
But that means that you would have to learn new rules, wouldn't you?
Well, again, because we had not used military commissions since 2000, since World War II, in the interim, the Uniform Code of Military Justice was enacted by Congress in 1950. And so that was going to, in my view, change significantly the rules that would be applicable at a military commission because of that act of Congress almost a half century ago.
But one point here, just to jump in, though, is that this idea of rules is really significant because there were no rules in the order that President Bush issued. It had basically two rules. It said that any evidence probative to a reasonable person could be used, which is essentially no rule because who would want to look at evidence that wasn't even probative? And the other rule was that the trial be full and fair, which is a kind of open-ended aspiration, but it's not exactly a rule.
But you also said that they were intended to speed up the legal process. How many suspected terrorists have been tried at Guantanamo Bay under the new system? We're talking about 11-plus years since the attack.
Well, speed has not been one of the virtues of this project. There have been two trials that you could call contested, and the convictions in them actually, which took many years to come about, were both vacated by the District of U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia last year and early this year.
Weren't the cases involving U.S. citizens that were transferred to the federal justice system tried at a much timelier pace?
Well, yes, because the U.S. Constitution has a speedy trial provision, and trials must take place within a certain period of time unless the defendant waives that right. However, only U.S. citizens, or rather, only foreign citizens can be tried in these military commissions. So there was no circumstance where a U.S. citizen would face this type of proceeding.
Although, Stuart, there was a suggestion that they be tried in regular U.S. courts, but Congress balked, a lot of other people balked. The mayor of New York at the time screamed bloody murder. Is one of the reasons that it's been difficult to bring many of the suspects held at Guantanamo Bay to trial that it wasn't clear what crimes they should be charged with?
Well, as far as the policy decisions about whether or not to do the military commissions is concerned, I'll leave that to commentators such as Jess. From my perspective, having been, for lack of a better term, on the worker bee prosecutor level, it was quickly apparent to us that the jurisdiction that military commissions has responsibility for involves violations of what we call the law of armed conflict. So that's necessarily a body of international law that we don't normally encounter in courts martial. However,
that was your specialty.
But being a military officer, being in military justice, we understand what violations of the laws of armed conflict are, but they differ significantly in some respects than what could be prosecuted in a federal district court. And I think that therein lies some of the tension and some of the problems that have arisen with these efforts to use military commissions.
Well, didn't the Geneva Conventions cover all of this?
No, it doesn't cover all of it, but there's an important distinction that arises when you consider the Geneva Conventions. That body of international law, as it goes to what violations of laws of armed conflict may have occurred, that's one part of international law. There's another part of international law that surrounds the issues of treatment of detainees once they are taken captive on the battlefield and taken out of combat. So in light of some of the enhanced interrogation techniques that were authorized under the Bush administration at that time, these two things now came into conflict. That is, on the one hand, we're trying to prosecute violations of the law of armed conflict that depend upon international law. At the same time, we now have issues arising about the treatment of these detainees under that same international law. And in a few of the cases that I dealt with, that's where that conflict came to a head.
But even that treatment aside, hadn't a number of suspects been imprisoned mainly because they were associated with al-Qaeda rather than because they had were suspected of committing a specific crime? And then there were other people who seemed to have been there mainly because the United States had offered a $5,000 reward for anyone who might be a suspect.
Leonard, that raises the issue that there were two things going on at Guantanamo at the same time. One, you've got a detention of enemy combatants. These are people that were taken off the battlefield that were engaged in conflict against the United States. So on the one hand, you've got the detention. On the other hand, there would be a subset of those enemy combatants taken off the battlefield that it was later determined may have committed a violation of the law of armed conflict, and then would go through the military commission's process. So there's two different issues happening. Sometimes they overlap, but I need to emphasize that you have these two separate considerations.
This is one of the most difficult abstractions to really make sense of for a lot of people. I mean, this came up initially when the press conference involving the Pentagon General Counsel tried to explain the rollout of military commissions, and it's a position that the Obama administration maintains to this day. You have to imagine there are two completely separate legal regimes in play involving the exact same people at the exact same place for much of the exact same conduct. One is retrospective, punishing them for specific crimes they committed in the past. And that requires, even in military commissions, a certain amount of evidence and proof and so on. And that is to punish them for something wrong they did. The other thing, this overlapping yet conceptually unrelated authority, is to prevent them from doing bad things in the future under the idea you capture enemy fighters. They may have a legal right to fight against you even, but you have a legal right to stop them from doing that. So those two overlapping things, and that's why this seemingly contradictory policy, he can be acquitted but still detained for the rest of his life, makes perfect sense to some lawyers. To a lot of people, hard to really square that idea.
But even with that in mind, the group behind the attack at Benghazi is called Ansar al-Sharia, and it's run by a man named Abu Sufyan bin Kumu, who had been held at Guantanamo, and he was just freed. So are we very can we even spot who might very well do something when he's released and others who might not?
Predicting the future remains a bit difficult for even the best of us.
Do we have any sense that the experience at Guantanamo might have actually radicalized this man?
I don't know about his case, but it is very clear that the Guantanamo experiment writ large, both the detention and the prosecution elements, has been very unpopular around the world, both with our own allies as well as potential adversaries.
Well, some suspects are known to have played a significant role in the 9/11 attacks, especially Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. But they were not initially held at Guantanamo. Where were they taken after they were arrested?
Well, the when prisoners were captured, the ones that were determined at first to be the most serious, what they call in the Guantanamo lingo, high value detainees, HVDs, those were sifted out by the CIA and taken to their secret prisons overseas. It was the lower value prisoners who were sent to Guantanamo into military custody.
And so you were on the you were on the inside.
Led to some of the problems that we had initially, in that we had these lower level responsibility detainees that were in custody of the Department of Defense at Guantanamo circa 2003, that we were told, hey, look, these are individuals that we have a reason to believe committed violations of laws of armed conflict, make a case. And the evidence against a lot of these detainees was solely their admissions of what they had done or statements of other detainees of what a particular detainee had done. And so the quantum of evidence against these individuals in most respects, not all, but in most respects, was sort of short, whereas the high-value detainees that we did not have in our custody at that time, the quantum of evidence against them and their culpability is much greater.
And were you aware of these high-value detainees?
We were.
And, did you have any sense of where they were being kept?
No, we did not.
Was there any talk about you prosecuting them?
Oh, that was always on the horizon. I mean, that was something we'd have talked about in the office, is that, you know, for right now, these are the detainees that we're going to be working on. But we always envisioned that we were starting the process that someday was going to culminate in military commissions against the 9/11 conspirators.
My guests are Jess Braven, who is a Supreme Court correspondent for The Wall Street Journal and the author of The Terror Courts, Rough Justice at Guantanamo Bay. It's published by Yale University Press. And one of the people he writes a lot about, former – are you still Lieutenant Colonel?
I'm retired now.
Retired Lieutenant Colonel Stuart Couch, who was a Marine Corps attorney, a prosecutor, who was deeply involved in this story. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Jess Braven, Supreme Court correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, who's covered the military commission story since 2001. He's written a book called Terror Courts, Rough Justice at Guantanamo Bay. It's published by Yale University Press. Also with us is retired Lieutenant Colonel Stuart Couch, who was a Marine Corps prosecutor involved in this. Did you, in trying to report the story, how soon did you come in contact with Stuart?
Actually, I met Stuart Couch, 6 years after I started covering Guantanamo Bay and military commissions. This is a story that has legs, as they say. And it was actually really fortunate to find someone whose experience in this project really touched on many of the most serious issues that that it raises.
And so outspoken about them. Stuart, you've said that you were unwilling to try to prosecute any detainee who'd been subject to special project interrogation. That's a code for what some people might call torture?
Well,
or is that about people who've been rendered to another country for interrogation, where torture might be used?
Well, let me clarify that I didn't make a blanket statement that I was not going to prosecute any detainee. What I did say was, after having been provided the facts, provided the evidence, and the source of that evidence, how it was obtained. At least in one of those occasions, I did state that as a legal, ethical, and ultimately a moral matter, I refused to prosecute his case.
And how did your higher-ups react to that?
Well, my the chief prosecutor, my boss at that time, did not react. He wasn't happy about it. We had a sort of a heated conversation about it. Subsequent to that conversation, I put my reservations in writing so that he would be able to share that. And what I thought at the time is that he would be able to share that with the upper echelons of leadership over at the Pentagon. If nothing else, to say, you know, Houston, we have a problem with this policy and how it has affected at least one of our cases. You know, shortly thereafter, I was basically told to shut up in color and start working on my other cases.
Well, was the decision ultimately the legal decision being made at the Pentagon, or wasn't it being made at the White House by people like John Yoo?
My understanding was that the policy was developed by John Yoo and others in the Office of Legal Counsel, and that they gave legal advice to individuals in the vice president's office, and ultimately it was adopted as policy and given to the Secretary of Defense
Donald Rumsfeld to
exercise that policy.
But this incident that Stuart's talking about really illustrates the disconnect here. The policymakers, many of whom had quite impressive academic pedigrees, conceived of something that would be a kind of almost a legal time machine to go back to the darkest days after Pearl Harbor, when many, many legal standards were thrown aside as the country reacted, and be able to prosecute enemy prisoners without giving them access to the evidence against them and so forth.
So the habeas corpus aspect of our legal system was kind of ignored.
It was not believed to apply by these people. But what they didn't count on, what a lot of these top level policymakers didn't count on, in drawing up these new rules or lack of rules on paper, they didn't count on people like Stuart Couch and others who had certain values really ingrained in them through their training and education and just the environment of growing up in America in the 20th, 21st century.
But I get the feeling, Stuart, that the trials at Guantanamo were routinely delayed when you were prosecutor because you and others understood how difficult it would be to win a case in which all of the evidence came as a result of torture and hearsay.
Actually, the delays that we experienced in the years 2003 to 2006, coerced interrogation problems with the evidence didn't even manifest itself in the delays that we had in the very initial stages. The delays that we experienced were related solely to these very large constitutional issues of separation of powers between the president's authority as a commander-in-chief versus congressional authority and responsibility under Article 1 of the Constitution. And so that was really what was being litigated at that time, and it ultimately decided by the Supreme Court in the case of Hamdan versus Rumsfeld in 2006.
Well, Jess, why do you think Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's case has been delayed so long, and what's its current status?
Well, his case has been delayed so long mainly because of the choice of the executive branch to not bring him to trial. For those first several years after he was captured, the Bush administration could have immediately transferred him to the United States for trial, but they had other interests, mainly intelligence, and that was, of course, has been explained. He was waterboarded and subjected to many cruel methods. In fact, at one point, as the book explains, Lieutenant Colonel Couch was asked to analyze the chances of prosecuting him. This was in 2004. And when he wrote a memo saying to prosecute Khalid Sheikh Mohammed will require disclosing what the United States has done to him, the Bush administration took that memo, filed it away, and left KSM in a black site.
Bring up
when he was brought to Guantanamo in 2006, only after the Supreme Court ruled that denying him the minimal treatment standards of the Geneva Convention was illegal.
Isn't it still unclear whether the torture even got any credible evidence out of him?
I'm not really aware, Leonard. Again, my focus on writing the memorandum that I did involving Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, I was provided with limited information. But I did know enough of information that I had read in what we call open source or just public media that I knew that the issue was going to manifest itself. And that's why in the memorandum that I wrote that's referenced in the book, I made the point of this is an issue that will raise itself in this case. I also stated that, in my view, this was perhaps the most significant criminal prosecution in the history of the nation, and so that we had better think about these things and be able to address them before we take it to trial.
Now, Jesse, you open your book with the story of how Salim Hamdan, Osama bin Laden's driver, was arrested. Was he among the first suspects shipped to the prison at Guantanamo Bay in the early days?
Yes, he was.
So from your descriptions, it seems clear that he was no terrorist mastermind. He had a fourth-grade education. He was a driver. Was he typical of many of the prisoners that were being held in Guantanamo at the beginning?
Well, the typical prisoner was not someone who spent all his time with Osama bin Laden. So in that sense, no. He was typical in that he was not a planner or organizer of major terrorist conspiracies.
And I do want to interject.
Was one of the cases you were involved
with. It was. I picked the case up after the previous prosecutor retired from the military. I do want to interject, though, that Hamdan, yes, he was responsible for the transportation for Osama bin Laden, but also he was one of his most trusted bodyguards. This was an individual that spent a lot of time with a physical distance no greater than where we're sitting from each other in the studio, away from Osama bin Laden, responsible for his personal security. So at the end of the day, Al-Qaeda can't get done what they want to get done and what they have done if the leader of that organization is subject to personal attack. So there's got to be some responsibility. However, I do disagree with the ultimate argument that the prosecutors that ultimately argued for 30 years to life for Hamdan. He wasn't really on the order of someone that would merit such a drastic sentence.
Is this similar to prosecuting the driver of the getaway car at a bank robbery? Somebody who was present during a murder, even though he said don't shoot?
Well, I would agree with the first example. I would disagree with the second. I think that you don't just get a pass if you were a bodyguard for Osama bin Laden. I don't think he deserves a pass. However, I think by the same token, we ought not ratchet that case up and try to argue that he is the worst of the worst. Held at Guantanamo Bay when he's put up against the facts of other cases.
It's more like prosecuting Hitler's driver while Hess and Goering are being held in some secret prison and tortured. I mean, that's really the analogy.
My guests are Jess Braven, who's written a book called The Terror Courts, and retired Lieutenant Colonel Stuart Couch, who was one of the prosecutors at those courts. The book is published by Yale University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Stuart, weren't you especially concerned when you learned that interrogators had threatened to have Hamdan's mother gang raped if he didn't cooperate?
That was actually the case of Mamdou Slahi.
Oh, okay.
It was not Hamdan.
Slahi being the only one where that might have been suggested?
To my knowledge, it was. And ultimately, the information that I reviewed that reflected presented to Slahi, to my knowledge, that was the only time that ruse had been used. However, that was all the background, if you will, as to why he ultimately gave the admissions that he gave. And in my legal judgment, the information that he gave up after he broke under interrogation was so intertwined with whatever quantum of evidence there would have been of his guilt. That's why as a legal matter and an ethical matter, I resolved that he had been tortured and that would not be able to be prosecuted.
Because that's a form of torture, just as waterboarding is a form of torture?
Well, the definition came from the United Nations Convention Against Torture and Other Inhuman, Cruel, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment that was ratified by the United States in 1996. Under Article 15 of that UN Torture Convention, it says, any evidence derived from torture shall not be used in any proceeding against this individual. And I took any proceeding to mean and include military commissions.
Now, Jess describes you in the book as a religious man. How large a role did your religious faith play in your decision to at first bring the 9/11 terrorists to justice and then later determined that you didn't want to work on some of these cases?
Well, I am a self-described evangelical Christian. I would say at the outset, my Christianity goes with me wherever I go. My involvement in military commissions, though, was as a result of my being a Marine Corps officer on active duty who happened to be a judge advocate and with a lot of experience as a prosecutor. So, but I would say what I do, just as if I were in any other line of work, my Christianity goes with me where I go. Ultimately, though, my faith was very instrumental once I had resolved in the Salahi case that as a legal matter, what had been done to him constituted torture and was subject to these exclusion provisions. As an ethical matter, as an attorney, I resolved that I would have to share the knowledge that I had with a defense attorney for Salahi if he got one in the future. But ultimately, what caused me to act was, in fact, informed by my faith as a Christian as to that I had to take the step of refusing to prosecute the case.
So what is the current status of Salahi?
To my knowledge, he does not have any pending charges.
So, but he's still at Guantanamo?
He is.
And we could just detain them forever?
Yes.
By the way, just to update you on him, his case is so fascinating, and that's why we spend so much time on it in the book and why I think it had such an impact on Stu as well. It's a case where you can't say torture didn't work. I mean, that was why he started talking, and what he said checked out. So you could say it worked there. It didn't work fast because, in the sense of a ticking bomb. It took weeks and weeks and weeks of all kinds of things. He got a lot of privileges at Guantanamo. He still has them. He's got his own cottage and a little patch of vegetables to grow and so forth because of his cooperation. He has a parallel habeas case trying to get out of Guantanamo, and a federal district judge ruled that the government did not have enough evidence to justify detaining him. The appeals court told the district court to reconsider that decision, and now the case is still pending. So his future is totally up in the air.
Let's go back to the beginning and talk about the origins of the military commission system that was created for Guantanamo Bay. I mentioned earlier the brainchild of John Yoo, who was at the time not in government. He was a law school professor at the University of California, Berkeley, later became deputy assistant attorney in the White House's Office of Legal Counsel.
I wouldn't say it was his brainchild, but he did work on the project once it had gotten some traction in the weeks after 9/11.
And he wrote an opinion piece for your newspaper, The Wall Street Journal.
He's written many opinion pieces for our newspaper and many other papers. He's quite a prolific writer.
But the one that I'm thinking about described a legal way that the Republicans could declare George Bush's victory over Al Gore in the contested 2000 presidential election that really had a major impact.
Well, this was, of course, before 9/11.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the reasons he came to the attention of the incoming Bush administration was that during that recount period after the November 2000 election, John Yoo wrote a very perceptive op-ed piece suggesting a legal strategy that ultimately was the one the Supreme Court adopted in deciding to halt the counting of votes in Florida with George Bush ahead.
And then he ended up co-authoring a declaration for the White House that classified the 9/11 attacks as an act of war.
That's right. He was involved in drafting.
That's different than a terrorist attack?
Well, there isn't a declaration of terrorist attack, so I guess so. I mean, it was the legal authority that Congress gave to President Bush to begin a response in Afghanistan. It was written by John Yoo and a deputy White House counsel named Tim Flanagan, and certainly with some input from many others, in a way to give President Bush as broad an authority as he could possibly imagine.
Well, wasn't it his contention that the military commissions weren't even necessary because President Bush could prosecute, convict, and execute prisoners at will under his expanded wartime powers?
Yes. And so in a sense, giving any process to people who you don't owe any kind of refuge to, whatever, could be looked as an act of mercy.
Is this similar to what we're seeing today with the drone attacks, where the president says, okay, you can go after this person?
Well, it is different for this big distinction. And that's when you capture an enemy prisoner, you can't, under international laws, as has been understood by most commentators, immediately put them to death. You have a certain duty to protect them and not permit them to undergo inhumane treatment and so on. If your enemy is at large and still fighting against you, you owe them a little less charity. So I don't know that the legal issues are precisely in alignment.
Stuart, you've said that you first recognized the interrogation methods being used against terrorism suspects when you visited Guantanamo in October 2003. Were a problem when you stumbled on a shackled detainee on the floor of a cell in which music was being played at an ear-splitting level?
Yes. I was there to – it was my first trip to Guantanamo, and I was going to observe an interview with one of the individuals that I had been assigned to prosecute, who was a very cooperative detainee, actually the subject of a pretty serious charges that have a lot of merit. While I was waiting for that interview, I heard music down the hallway, and when I went out and rounded the corner, I saw into one of the interrogation rooms a strobe light, heavy metal rock music playing, and a detainee shackled to the floor. My concern with what I saw was it was the same treatment that I myself had received at a school run by the military for our training of aviators of how to conduct ourselves if we were taken captive by an enemy.
Was it all that different from the way people were being treated at Bagram, which you also visited?
I was unaware of – I didn't see anything at Bagram, but I have read reports and had interviews that reflected similar treatment.
Did you leave the military soon after this?
No. After Hamdan versus Rumsfeld was decided in 2006, I was reassigned. I was an appellate judge for my last 3 years.
And now you work in the Justice Department.
And since retirement, I'm now an immigration judge in Charlotte.
And I thank you both so much for being on our show. I've been speaking to retired Lieutenant Colonel Stuart Couch and to Jess Braven, whose book, The Terror Courts, Rough Justice at Guantanamo Bay, is published by Yale University Press. It's been a scary pleasure.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thanks, Leonard.